Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I gotta say, that was the most refreshing little extended weekend that we just finished. The 4th was quiet around here. I spent the day tending my smoker, getting a couple of pork shoulders ready for Saturday. And then Saturday was really the highlight of the weekend. Because Agnes and I and the Munchkins all went down off our mountain and went up on Larry Gibson. We left here in driving sheet-like rain and slowly drove out of it until we got down to the Cabin Creek exit and then began wandering our way back up into the hollows and hills headed for the Stanley Ayres Park. And made our way up the mountain there for the Mountain Keepers Music Festival. And what a delightful afternoon we all had. I can't tell you how much fun we did have. The kids got their faces painted up. There was delicious food all over the place. Big old potluck. And homemade potato salad. I have a potato salad problem in addition to a cheese problem. I have a food problem. But anyway, there was fabulous music, gorgeous music. I shared some of the itinerary with you on Thursday evening. I got pressed into duty as an impromptu auctioneer. Oy. I know nothing about auctioneering, but we had a great little auction. Beautiful baby quilt was sold, and it was gorgeous. Some music, some DVDs, that kind of thing. Some professional photography of the mountains. Just exquisite stuff. And there were just what a gathering of dedicated, joyful, committed individuals that was. There were folks from all over creation there up at the Stanley Ayres Park. And that place, I had never been there. And I can't wait to go back again soon. Ed Wiley was there, whom you've heard on this program. Judy Bonds was there, whom you've heard on this program. Lorella Scarborough was there, whom you've heard on this program. Nick, who pops into the chat room from time to time, was there. You've heard him on the program, too. Maria Gano was there. There were just oodles of people there. And it was a two-day event. We only got to go for the first day. I would have loved to have brought a tent and camped and just stayed. It was just wonderful. And I got to wander out, and I am still, I'm a changed man. I got to wander out, about a mile or so, to the edge of the Stanley Ayers Park property. And you walk through the woods. It's a typical walk on top of a mountain, down a well-established trail. I was walking in company with a photographer of some considerable talents. And we were talking about what's going on here, why it's happening. And she showed me a place where the mountain itself is shearing away. And I just looked in stunned amazement. But we made a turn, and we kept walking, and pretty soon the greenery broke away, everything cleared off, and there before us, like some picture window into hell itself, was the massive devastation that is mountaintop removal. The Stanley Ayers Park that Larry Gibson has preserved, the 50 little pristine acres in the middle of mountaintop removal devastation, is amazing, simply amazing. And it should be a national shrine, because it's one of the only places that I know of. I think it may be the only place that I know of where you can go and walk on your own 2 feet without crossing through any mine guards or having to deal with any mine thugs or any mine company authorities, and just watch them do the evil that they do on a daily basis. It was quiet. It was the 5th of July when we were there. It was a Saturday. So there weren't a lot of people, there wasn't a lot of activity. But you could see where they were setting and getting ready for more charges, more explosions, more devastation. I asked someone, I was told the whole thing goes something like 7 miles by 7 miles. It was hell on earth as far as the eye could see. A crow trying to fly across that place would have to pack a lunch. And it was pretty, it was certainly moving. It was certainly something that I will not soon forget, if ever. But then to turn around and go back to where the festival was taking place, and to hear all that gorgeous music, big old upright basses and banjos and mandolins and guitars, band after band after band, a cappella music that would just make the little hairs on the back of your neck stand on end. And again, the food, which mostly I just looked at. And the fun and the children, and there were dogs, and there was a group that had come from around the Knoxville area who were sitting cleaning mustard greens and poke greens into a pot for a big old mess of greens. There were folks from Kentucky, there were folks from Virginia, there were folks from Tennessee. Our pals Michael and Jen came all the way from Columbus, Ohio to videotape and record the event for posterity. I fear they got video footage of me, my debut as an auctioneer, and I stand in horror at the thought. But it was wonderful to get to meet them. We had a couple of other listeners, one from Massachusetts, who said, "You got a lot of people really, really love to listen to you in Salem, Bob," and that made a tingle run down my spine. And all of that good spirit, No one admitting defeat. No one mentioning defeat. No one mentioning giving up. No one mentioning that somehow perhaps compromise needed to be reached. None of that. A celebration of good fellowship and a commitment to, as the old saying goes, stay one day longer than the company. One day longer. And I was just got home and had that good tired feeling of having been on one's feet all afternoon long and walking around. Oh, I love being out in the woods. It's just magic. So, I would recommend any of you, if you ever get a chance to go to an event at the Stanley Ayres Park on Cayford Mountain, out Cabin Creek in southern West Virginia, I heartily recommend that you do so. Find a way. And if you're just passing through, if you will make contact with Larry Gibson, I'll bet you he'll find a way for you to get up there and see the world as he sees it. I didn't get to go out to the best view of the devastation, the best view of hell unleashed on earth. That's at another point of access called Hell's Gate, and it is. We couldn't get to that because there was a possibility of being harassed by some mine company thugs. But I will, because we'll be back. We'll go back. I promised Larry that we would, and we will. So if you ever get the chance, I hope you will as well. So that's what a magnificent way to spend Independence Day weekend. And by the way, for those of you who don't want to just download the whole show for a few more days, I got a lot of emails saying, you know, wow, that was really cool what you did with the Declaration of Independence on Thursday. There is a link, or there is a thread at Democratic Underground, democraticunderground.com, to just the audio of the Declaration of Independence comments. It's about a half an hour long. I think the name of the thread is Happy Independence Day, Bob Kincaid on the Declaration of Independence. If you go and search it out in general discussion, there's a link to a YouSendIt.com upload that'll be good for 4 more days if you want to download that and keep it for posterity or just your own later enjoyment or whatever. So, yeah, you can do that. Now, what else is going on in the world? There is an abundance going on in the world, and there's some going away from the world. Let's start with that. Oh, quick program note. I'm not sure if there's going to be a live Strictly Confidential tonight with Peter Godbold. Not because Peter is not sure whether he wants to do a show or not. Peter very badly wants to do a show, but he's having trouble with the two rusty, dented tomato cans and a string that constitute the Internet service with which he is provided and charged dearly for each month. Thought everything was okay, and then just about an hour or so ago, I got a note saying that everything had just gone to hell with his connection again. So, please, all I can tell you is stick around, and maybe we'll know a little bit more along about 8:30 or so. Things going on in the world and things going away from the world. Well, a thing went away from the world on the 4th of July. And it was one of those things that I was terribly, terribly glad to see go away. Former North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms shuffled off to hell. And it was about darn time. What, 86 years old? Evil, evil, evil man. But you know that. Just for the sake of argument, however, to let you know how evil... Our good buddy Bart Kopp dug up some quotes from him. Back in 1950, in a political campaign, Jesse Helms said the following. White people, wake up before it is too late. Do you want Negroes working beside you, your wife and your daughters in your mills and factories? Frank Graham favors mingling of the races. 13 years hadn't mellowed him. In a commentary on WRAL-TV in 1963, Jesse Helms declared, "The Negro cannot count forever on the kind of restraint that's thus far left him free to clog the streets, disrupt traffic, and interfere with other men's rights." And even as recently as February the 8th, 1981, he still wasn't getting any better. In the New York Times on that day, Jesse Helms said the following: "Crime rates and irresponsibility among Negroes are a fact of life which must be faced." Makes my eyes cross. Honest to God, it does. And as recently as August the 5th, 1993, regarding Carol Moseley Brown, for a time a senator from the state of Illinois, Jesse Helms said, as quoted in the Chicago Sun-Times, "I'm going to make her cry. I'm going to sing Dixie until she cries." Bartkopf says, "The world is a better place with that mean old prick dead." And I agree. There's that whole business of, what is it? It's the Thumper theory of social interaction. You remember Thumper from Bambi? "Thumper, what have I told you? If you can't say anything nice, don't say nothing at all." I, for one, refuse to be silent about an evil, old hate monger like Jesse Helms. It's Jesse Helms that makes me want to believe in that burning hell that the likes of Falwell were so fond of reminding us about. I want to believe in it because I want, oh yes, Lord, I want Jesse Helms to be right there. In fact, my sick, twisted imagination is such that when I saw in Eugene Finnerman's Your RDA of Irony that he had noted, "It is Jesse Helms' first day in hell. I hope that he was forced to watch Venus and Serena Williams compete at Wimbledon. Better yet, I hope that Helms' head was transmuted into the tennis ball." When I saw that, I couldn't help noting to Eugene that the Hell's Corner Walgreens lunch counter is getting a lot of help these days. What with Jesse Helms, you know, he's the new guy, so he starts at the bottom scraping dishes. Jesse Helms scraping dishes and George Wallace bussing tables. Richard Nixon on the broiler, literally. Ronald Reagan taking orders at the counter. Gerald Ford whining at the cash register. And Lester Maddox waiting tables, and Satan tells me that Lester looks fabulous in the skirt and heels. I've heard Lester gets really mad every time somebody pinches his tushy, which is constantly the job being eternal and it being hell and everything. So goodbye. Good riddance. Cart him out to sea in an old rusty toxic waste barrel and just weight it down and let it sink. Then again, why would you want to do that to the marine life? And finally, one last thing about Jesse Helms. One last little reminder. The dirty, rotten, filthy, vile, nasty Jesse Helms Hands ad that he ran when he was nigh unto being beat in a North Carolina Senate race. Listen to this overt pornography, this obscenity.
You needed that job, and you were the best qualified. But they had to give it to a minority because of a racial quota. Is that really fair? Harvey Gantt says it is. Gantt supports Ted Kennedy's racial quota law that makes the color of your skin more important than your qualifications. You'll vote on this issue next Tuesday. For racial quotas, Harvey Gantt. Against racial quotas, Jesse Helms.
Never mind the fact that there was never such any such thing as a racial quota bill. It was a bill to, what, minimize the effects of racial decisions in hiring practices, racist decisions. Sadly, Jesse Helms' death came about 86 years too late. And I'm not going to do that whole smarmy, well, you know, I'm sorry for his family who are bad and his and they're missing him and they're in their grief right now. Milquetoast, McSpittle. I'm not going to do that. If we have come to a point in this country where when an evil old racist dies, we can't say good riddance to an evil old racist, we're in worse shape than I thought. He was a homophobe. He was a racist. He was a sexist. He was everything that could possibly be cited as wrong with this country. And at least a little bit in the positive column of this country's hope for a better future, the old POS is dead, and good riddance to bad rubbish. A lot of other stories on the plate tonight, but let's start out with the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, brother. How you doing?
Hey, what's up, Albert?
You know, enjoyed the nice weekend. Now it's raining, la, 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 and Jesse Helms is gone.
The air smells a little sweeter, doesn't it?
It does. It certainly does. And speaking of air smelling sweeter, I know I've been giving you a kind of updates on Wisconsin burning up West Virginia. The people here are really seriously mobilizing in just a fantastic way. I am seeing signs everywhere for no coal ash dump, no more coal, la 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 la, that one and so forth, and it's just a beautiful thing. And I really look forward to the day. I mean, I spend more money to have wind power, especially now that I see coal mountaintop removal. And I'll tell you what, it's coming, Bob. It just is. I know it is. I know it is. I know it is.
And that was the attitude. That was the attitude that I saw manifested on the mountain Saturday.
Yeah. Oh.
There was nobody hanging their heads. There was nobody saying, "Oh, you know." No. They're doing their damnedest, but eventually we win. We've already won.
Yes, indeed.
It's a matter of when they quit.
Yeah, it's a matter of terms of when they finally realize it. And you know, I just got, you know, speaking of, just to kind of keep it on the thread of Helms and his bigotry and phobic ways, you heard what Fred Barnes said this weekend, right?
Yeah, that John McCain has to turn his campaign and do a little more gay bashing.
Yeah, a little more gay bashing. You know, and it's one of them things that, you know, a guy wearing a yellow Dolce & Gabbana suit jacket really shouldn't be talking about, you know, anything bad about gays. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I saw the suit jacket, and yes.
Come on. And just like, come on, who are you kidding? But anyhow, and I realized today, and I know it's been one of those things all the time, you know, when you get that knowledge that you know you've had, and all of a sudden then you realize, oh, that's how it is, you know, but I knew I always knew it. And, you know, it's just one of those things where the reason they don't want gays in the military, you know why, Bob. You know why. Because they don't want to serve. They want to use that as like a cyst. They want to, you know, use that as like, you know, to be, oh, I get headaches. I can't serve. I can't be in the military. You know, so now they just want to be able to say that. And I'll tell you, I served in the Navy, and my best friends in the Navy were all gay. You know, so that, you know, when they talk about this kind of stuff where, you know, gays, and it's just the biggest, it's just hoopla. That's all it is. That's really all it is. Wait, hang on one second. Stop. Okay. So, you know, it's just one of them things that, you know, just to kind of bring it all back.
Well, here, you want to wrap it around a little bit more, Albert? Let's check this out. You've heard the name Charlie Black, right?
Mm-hmm.
McCain's advisor?
Yeah.
Big buddies, pals, all of that?
Mm-hmm.
Guess whose campaign Charlie Black worked on back in the 90s? Guess who was partially responsible for that Hands ad whose audio I just ran?
Shocking. Isn't it shocking?
Yeah, that's right. Charlie Black. You betcha. What a guy. What a guy. And, you know, you're known by the company you keep, so you're a class act, John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also a Republican, so who the heck is he supposed to get to help him out with his campaign? They're all racist bastards.
It's sad and true. And you know, it just, and I just got to, I want to get back to the troops for one second. You know, there's troops that they continuously just throw out and flush. You know, when we're sitting here with sending troops three, four, maybe five tours in a row, or, you know, they get 30 days off with their family and they go right back, you know, guys coming back. But, you know, now we're seeing iconic pictures. We see iconic pictures of, you know, all these guys, you know, the Marlboro man, and you see the problems that he's having. We see the, you know, the one guy just died from a drug overdose or inhaling.
Right. Yeah, he's in the stack. And what a daggum tragedy that is. Heartbreaking.
I mean, I've cried before, and, you know, I'm talking to you and stuff, and, you know, and I don't miss the Navy, you know, but I do miss my friends, and I was in the Navy. So it's one of those things where, you know, these guys, we need this. And it should be just like, I don't know, maybe constitutional amendment. The draft has to be solid. We have to have a draft. We continuously have to have a draft. A, to keep this lesson that you and I and all the people that are of consciousness who can look at a picture, read a story, and feel and empathize with it. But we need to keep this stuff fresh in the minds of everyone. We can't let people just ignore this kind of stuff, because this is what's happening. How many troops? What is it? Is it it's like 75 a week or a day or 1,000 a month that are attempting suicide or completing suicide? And anybody who's ever had suicide touch their lives knows just how unbelievable of an abomination it is to, you know, just how you feel. It's disgusting. And, you know, when we sit here and if we had a draft, you know, it would get these guys that, you know, nobody can take that kind of stuff. You know, there are a couple of guys. You know,
well, the question, Albert, is what is that kind of stuff? And first of all, let's say this guy's name. Let's remember this fellow because he deserves remembering. If maybe a few people from the Bush administration would have remembered him, maybe we wouldn't be talking about a dead guy. It's like some sort of really, really sick, soulless manifestation of the what the Sports Illustrated curse is? If you wind up on the cover of Sports Illustrated, rotten things happen for your season. Well, this is the Iraq War photography curse. I mean, we've got the Marlboro man who, if I recall correctly, his marriage fell apart, just tormented by PTSD, drinking, the typical the tragic carrying on when he went back to his home in the hills in Kentucky. And now we've got Joseph Patrick Dwyer, 31 years old, who dies of a drug overdose. He was popping pills and huffing inhalant the day he died. Because nothing would take the horror out of his brain and out of his heart and out of his soul, Albert.
I know. And this is I mean, not for nothing, this is what I say, you know, like, A, they need to be relieved. You know, I mean, nothing, you know, they need to be relieved. More people need to be exposed to it. We cannot sit there and take, you know, our gluttonous greed that drives wars like this and just allow a select few who do not get compensated for nowhere near the amount. I'm not trying to say, you know, let's pay every troop $1 million, but, you know...
But if we weren't paying $100,000 a year to the Blackwater mercenaries of the world, we could talk about a pay increase, and we could talk about more effective psychological counseling inside the real military. Sure we could. You know, this guy didn't just come up out of the blue. At the time that he reached his final crisis, he called a taxi. Albert, he called a taxi to take him to the hospital. The cab driver couldn't get into the house. The cops showed up, and he yelled for him to please knock the door down and get him to the hospital. Okay? But it didn't just come up out of the blue. In October 2005, he said he thought there were Iraqis outside of his window in El Paso.
Yep.
And when he heard a noise, he started shooting. 3 hours later, police finally got him to come out, and nobody got hurt. Captain Floyd Thomas of the Pinehurst, North Carolina Police Department said, of course he was looked on as a hero here. We've been dealing with him for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
We've been dealing with him for over a year. So the Pinehurst Police Department gets to deal with him. And maybe the neighbors get to deal with him. But the one group that won't deal with him is the group that he made look so doggone good. That photograph of him made a household face out of him for a time from, what was it, the first week of the war, Albert?
Yeah, it was
where he's carrying a half-naked little Iraqi child to get help. Even if you opposed the war, you looked at that photograph and said, that much is doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States Army just lets this guy spiral into it's too weak a word to call where he was hell. You know, the comments from his mama are heartrending. His mama said he just couldn't get over the war. He just couldn't do it. Just wasn't Joseph. Joseph never came home.
Yep. And you know, he won't be counted as a casualty of this war.
Oh, heck no. He's tough luck, Joseph. Maybe he'll get a tough luck letter from George Bush.
Yeah, well, he'll get a... well, hopefully right now he's strangling Jesse Helms. But, you know, you sit there and you look at guys like him. What does the Army tell? What does the Army say? He had a condition before he even came to us. Yeah, going there and killing women and children and, you know, being waist deep in blood and, you know.
And that's, okay, you just hit the second question.
Yep.
What is it that these soldiers, these Marines, what are they seeing that's doing this to them?
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, because of the story that came out today, we've seen that, and there was a previous follow-up, or there was a precursor story to it last week. Journalists and photojournalists and videographers in Afghanistan have had their equipment taken from them. They've had their film ripped out. They've had their memory cards pulled from their cameras. They are not allowed to show the reality of war. And now you've got an award-winning photojournalist who is kicked out of Iraq by the United States Marine Corps for taking a picture of a dead Marine. What is it that is happening there that is destroying these minds, destroying these lives, and the numbers that you mentioned that we're not allowed to know about?
Well, you know, and you know, you're already on the cutting edge of consciousness. And so is everyone who listens to this. So we know this kind of stuff. Questions like this is our answer. You know, when people don't get counted... You know, people don't get counted because, you know, he got wounded in Iraq. And, well, the minute the plane's wheels left the tarmac, he died. But he doesn't count. He died in Germany. He died at home from his wounds. You know, these people don't count. these people sit there and they're like, to us, we care about that, and they should count. You know, we care about that, and that's why the troops' funerals should be photographed. This is why, I mean, you know, but everything they do is to obscure, I can't speak, but you know what I'm saying, is to obscure the real true picture of this war. They're sitting there kicking out journalists for taking pictures. You know, and this is the kind of thing, I mean, hopefully it's coming to an end soon.
Hopefully it is. But there's a contrast. There is a very clear contrast, Albert, with the story of Joseph Patrick Dwyer.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the story of Joshua Key. Joshua Key deserted from the United States military in March of 2005. He was a private. He was on a two-week break from serving as a combat engineer in Iraq. He says he was involved in military-condoned home invasions against civilians, and he applied in Canada for refugee status. And he won his appeal in the last few days.
Mm-hmm.
The Immigration and Refugee Board was ordered by a federal court justice named Richard Barnes in Canada to reconsider the claim that they had rejected by Joshua Key. And he said, Barnes did, that the court reviewed the application too narrowly, interpreted the refugee eligibility too narrowly, because they said that only soldiers who seek protection from committing war crimes need apply. This is what he said. This is the quote. Officially condoned military misconduct falling well short of a war crime may support a claim to refugee protection. He said it cannot be seriously challenged that some of the conduct in which Keyes participated violated the Geneva Convention. And you see this, do you see why I say that there's a sort of a parallel or a dovetail between these two stories? Private Key deserted because Private Key had seen enough.
Yep.
But Private Key is in Canada, and we're still not hearing about what goes on. We're not hearing, I would imagine that in the extremis of the moment, and I am only imagining here, in the extremis of the moment, whatever one does under orders is justifiable in the short run. It's only when the brain gets an opportunity to do long-term processing that the trouble starts. Have I got it right, do you think?
I think so. Once shock subsides, then you can think rationally. And you can sit there and go, yeah, I know they told me to fire. I know they said it was a free fire zone. But Jesus, there was nothing but women and children in the streets. And, you know, I don't know if it was my bullet that did it, but I know I fired bullets. And, you know, you can't help but feel guilty. And, you know, that guilt, and guilt is one of the worst forms of torture that there is. You know, because when you're guilty about taking something that you can't, they don't even want to hear. They don't want to hear an apology in this country. But you have nobody to even apologize to. You know, nobody's going to sit there and wash your feet from this kind of stuff. And, you know, because you also feel like, you know, you can't even relate to anybody else. You know, because, you know, it's not every day that, you know, you run into a, you know, mass murderer. Which isn't that what it is? And, you know, not for nothing, I'm not trying, you know, disparage these guys. If put in the same situation, how can I say that I wouldn't do the same thing? I mean, you're getting fired upon, or you're ordered to do something. Well, God damn it, Bob, you better do it. Because if you don't, you could die. Your friends can die. And this is the sad thing that we're in this situation. It's like, you know, there's this schism. This whole war is schizophrenic. You know, because it's on the one hand, you got the Iraqis that were supposed to be liberating, and all we really accomplished in liberating from them is them, their souls from their vessels. You know, and at the other hand, you got troops over there, you know, believing that, you know, a lot of them believed, oh, 9/11, well, Saddam did that, and we all know the truth of that. And you got B, they're put in these impossible situations to where they are going to commit murder. It's murder. I don't care. You pull the trigger, and your bullet enters someone's brain or what have you and blows off a limb, you just committed murder. You know, how do you sit there and talk?
You've committed, I don't know, you have committed a homicide.
A homicide, okay. All right.
And then the brain kicks in trying to figure out, not by some legal standard, but just by the standards of common humanity, common to us all inside, in what goes on in our hearts and between our ears, was it justifiable homicide? When the guy's on the ground and the guy doesn't have a weapon and there's five people around him screaming, kill him, kill him, kill him, and you pull the trigger, your soul gets to work that one out.
Mm-hmm.
This particular case coming out of Canada, there's another quote that I think is profound. Judge Barnes said that dodging orders that are contrary to the basic rules or norms of human conduct is enough grounds to apply for refugee protection, and went on to say military action, this is big, military action which systematically degrades, abuses, or humiliates either combatants or non-combatants is capable of supporting a refugee claim where that is the proven reason for refusing to serve. This guy, Justice Barnes, he also sits on courts martial. So he is not unfamiliar with codes of military conduct. That's a lot.
Yeah, it is. But statements like that give me hope. we're only going to get so close to the brink before it just kicks in. And I think it's kicking in now, and I think, we're starting to see, massive upswells of change. When you talk about around the world, when you sit there and you talk about people around the world, everybody. I don't know, how many people can you find around the world that could justify what we've done in Iraq? Nobody. You won't find anybody that's not personally benefiting, with millions of dollars in their pocket.
Or who hasn't been already enlisted as cannon fodder for the culture wars, the right-wingers of the free republics and red states of the world. They're doing it for free.
The morons,
exactly.
Morons.
Mr. Key particularly said that he took part in at least 70 raids on civilian homes, Albert.
Yeah.
70.
Yeah, 70. I'll tell you what, I'm sure you have too. I've seen the footage. It's not like, you go in there, it's like women screaming and you're waking up children and, I remember the first footages from the Haditha massacre. And I remember, I remember watching that and saying, the girls, why did you kill my family? You killed them. They got bombed, and so all of a sudden, the whole town becomes a free fire zone, so you start shooting into a house with our, high-velocity rounds that penetrate walls and, throw grenades into a room where Grandpa's sleeping. These kinds of things that, they force, Marines and Army guys and, contractors, I don't know. I haven't heard much about contractors coming home killing themselves. I don't know. Maybe money is the salve that, soothes their soul, or maybe they're...
Or maybe they've got some level of services coming to them on a corporate basis. Because with the money that we paid to these organizations, they can afford it. And that's why it's hard for our military to afford it, Albert, because we have sucked the military into a husk, pulling the life out of it, so that we can support the private armies that were put together not by constitutional act and certainly not by Congress, but rather by executive fiat as a sort of private army. There we are. We're back at the Declaration again, aren't we? The Declaration of Independence. He has sent across the seas private armies. Well, granted, the private armies were going in the opposite direction, but the Blackwaters of the world have old apartheid knee breakers from South Africa in them. They have El Salvadoran right-wing death squad veterans in them. There are from all over the world.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. I was just going to say the people that are doing these contractors have already been filtered. They've already been shown that all they are is really hardcore killers. And, it's like there's a line from Paris. I don't know if Paris is a black nationalist kind of guy, but I do like a lot of stuff that he says. And I looked at information from all sources. And he says, regarding 9/11, but mostly in just in terms of the kinds of people that we're talking about, he says, you think a couple thousand lives mean shit to killers? These people are killers, Bob. These people are hardcore killers. They don't care. They couldn't care less. You won't see these contractors committing suicide because of things they've done.
No, but they are rethinking their service, Albert.
I'm sure they will, but, you know, there are a lot of sociopaths out there. There are a lot of psychos. Psychos, straight-up psychos, you know. And then, you know, granted, you know, guys like Morans, you know, the tough guys, the phony tough with their American flag bandanas, they might not be able to, you know, have the physical characteristics required to get a job with one of these people. But I'll tell you what, they'd probably be able to operate one of them predator drones or one of those kinds of things like that and just, you know, just kill people. You know, that's also, you know, and this mentality is the kind of, this is the cancer of humanity that needs to get cut out. This is the kind of person that John McCain is. You know, like, you know, this is one of those things that, you know, I always noticed. I remember a friend of mine growing up, his dad was an Air Force bomber pilot, you know, like B-52 bomber. And, you know, the guy was, you know, he had his little comb-over hairdo, like, you know, the poofy, you know, right-wing type hairdo. And he had one of those kind of hairdos, and he was just, you know, you see him and you think he was well-balanced, and then you find out, like, the kinds of things he did. And, you know, honestly, I don't know if in the darkness of the night, you know, while he's halfway down a scotch bottle, I don't know if it ever got to him. But I'll tell you what, he never exposed it, like, you know, I'll tell you what, my uncle was in Vietnam, and he was a helicopter gunner. And so he had to do some atrocious things. And I'll tell you what, I saw it in him far more than I did in the, you know, the B-52 bomber, who never even saw what he was doing. You know, like, you sit there, and when you talk about napalm in a child or napalm in a village, you know, you got to know you're going to be killing somebody. I mean, that's terrorism. I don't know. They talk about terrorism. We have the most efficient terror system on Earth. That's when you sit there and you look where, you know, we've got these missiles, fire and forget tank missiles and video games that teach you how it is in the Army, you know, and you get to play that for free. You know, you sit there and you desensitize killing and you turn killing into a reaction. You know, I guarantee you, like, it is, no matter what, that's one of the things that messed up all the Vietnam veterans. And that's one of the things that really messed up this psychological conditioning to not even just, you know, think that you're shooting a person. Is to just react. You know, when you're sitting there talking about troops on the ground that, you know, just react.
Yeah.
Just out of hand, just out of training. And, you know, then get to see the aftermath of it. Then, you know, we see why they're scrambled eggs. You know, we see why, man, they can't even love anymore. And you know what? To me, that's one of the most egregious crimes of all. Is you're literally sucking the heart out of these people. Out of our troops, you know, we sit there, we care about our troops. Nobody cares. They don't care about your troops. They don't care about you, period. You know, I got friends now. Oh, man, you know, the economy's desperate. You know, just according to plan, the economy's desperate. So what are people doing? Man, I can't pay for the schooling. I can't do this. I got to join the military. And I got two friends, that real friend, not the Republican, fake Republican guy. I got friends now. One of them joined the Navy, or another one joined the Army. Why? Because they got no choice. They got no choice, Bob. They got to eat. And, you know, you sit there, how much food? You got little ones. I got little ones. I mean, I sit there and I look, man, what happens if I got no choice? I mean, literally got no choice. I have no choice, but I have to feed my kids. Would you joke? You know, hey, Bob, you know, they're getting the guys older and older and older. And I'm not trying to say you're old, but I'm just trying to say.
No, I am. I'm too. Look, the fact of the matter is, when this all fired up, let's see, yeah, I was 40.
Yeah.
And I had just turned 40. And I actually called a recruiter out.
Really?
Yeah, I did. I said, you got anything the college-educated 40-year-old that you'd need done? And the recruiter goes, nah, it's okay, sir. We've got it covered. We'll do fine. We'll be out of there. We'll be out of there in no time flat. Well, we ain't out of there, and they're still up in the age. Fortunately, by the time I turned 43, they'd upped the age to 40. You know, they're trying to, you know.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, but this is where we're at now. You know, now we're going to be at this point, and this, you know, that's why another reason I want to see the draft, because you know, the minute that draft comes. That'll knock them off their ass. That'll get people up off the couch. And that's one of the things. That's why they don't want the draft. And you know it as well as I do. You know it as well as I do. They'd rather destroy the economy, as they're doing, destroy the dollar, as they're doing, you know, completely subjugate us into these totally fake and fraudulent oil prices, okay, this total illusion. And they would rather just make the illusion a little bit more uncomfortable and in turn grab recruits in that way. You know, in terms of, that's why I want to see a draft. I want to see a draft. You bet. I'm a liberal. I want to see a draft. You can even try to draft me. I'm fine with that. Okay, because I know that the minute they put up that draft, it's all over. It's done.
That's among other things, it's done because all of a sudden American collegiate's fat will be in the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, it's done. It really is. And you say, you know, they can, well, look, whether it's a, look at a draft, okay? Let's back up. Let me play history for a minute here. I have, and Agnes has, the old enlistment draft cards for both her father and mine. And her father was exempted because he was deemed a someone who was doing a necessary job at home. He was a coal miner.
Oh.
And they wanted him in there digging out the coal.
Yep.
My father was younger than hers was, and had just gotten out of high school. He was drafted. You know what his draft card says as far as time of separation? Duration. In other words, you know, there's no going home unless it's feet first or, you know, you leave something on the battlefield.
Yeah, true.
So the question for me turns back around to what we were initially making inquiry over. And that is, what in the hell is going on there that is so much worse than what we did, for instance, in the Second World War, in which there was no surcease of sorrow, in which there was no end of horror, in which, you know, guys stood in front of caves with flamethrowers at 30 yards or 30 feet and just roasted everything inside.
I think I might even have an answer to that.
I want to hear it.
All right. Well, besides the fact of, you know, and we just got to brush this up real quick, because it's important that people realize what our military learned about World War II is, you know, World War II only had like a 20% rate of return fire. A lot of the guys in them, and you know, that got in the war just fired and ducked their head or, you know, cried to mommy. And, you know, we talk about, but in reality, when the bullets start flying, you know, not everybody can sit there and react. So what they did was that's why they trained the people to react to targets. You know, you're not killing a body, you're killing a target. You're shooting at a target. And that's what they do in terms of that psychological breakdown, which is why I think we saw, you know, more so, and we saw this after Korea, and then Vietnam is when they started to institute this, and then, in the subsequent wars, which is why I think we see a lot more psychological damage out of those wars. Not to say that people in World War II didn't come back messed up, because I know they certainly did, but we just see it in a higher capita, you know, than we did then. Now you got that. Now here's the other thing. World War II, well, you know, and I hate to say justified, but in a way, we were the good guys, at least in terms of the way history paints it. We were the good guys. Everyone that served believed this. We didn't go in and kick in houses and, you know, take people away and, you know, take away and then torture them. You see, and I didn't think in terms of consciously, you know, just the consciousness of we're wrong. This is a war of aggression. This is actually not a war of defense. This is a war of aggression. No matter what the troops feel, and you know what, brainwashing only goes so far. You know, they didn't brainwash me, I think, but they didn't brainwash me. I still was myself when I got out of boot camp. You know, and I still thought and felt, and you know, I have my heart. You know, they didn't completely suck it out of me, because they can't. You can't do that. You can just train somebody to react, but other than that, you can't sit there and change the way they completely think. So when you sit there and look at what we're doing now, we're in the wrong. We're completely in the wrong. So I don't even think in terms of, you know, some sort of psychological, metaphysical consciousness barrier. We don't even have a justification. You know, it's like not only, you know, God forbid somebody, you know, they actually kill. I'm not saying we never killed an innocent in World War II. We did firebomb Dresden. We did nuclear bomb, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki and those kinds of things, you know. But like, if you sit there and look, those guys that actually did that were like, well, we were under attack, we did and we wanted to end the war, so we did. You see, in this respect, we don't have any moral footing. We don't have any ethical grounds from which to say that all this killing we've done, you know, and indirectly and directly, all this blinding, Bob, I'm sure you've seen it, man. And this is a reason why they sit there and they don't want Marines and all these guys taking pictures. However, technology, as you know, but, you know, I mean, I remember the pictures from 2003, 2004, 2005, you know, of Fallujah and all these other places where literal, you know how they have those open streams. Man, running blood, rivers of blood, Bob. No joke, literal rivers of blood.
Yeah, like biblical stuff, yeah.
Exactly, biblical rivers of blood. And we're sitting there doing these things and making these soldiers do these things with no ethical barrier, with only, for what? For what? To enrich a few people? To distract people from Donald Rumsfeld saying the Pentagon lost $2.3 trillion? That all the billions that we've wasted and lost? Lost. I love that. I love that. That's one of my favorites. It's almost as much, I love that as much as I love when I hear scientists, like in the LIGO, which is where they're looking for gravity waves, and they say, oh, we have a non-detection. You have a non-detection. You have a non-detection of gravity. You lost $1 billion. What? How do you do these things? How can you possibly do that? Dad, I lost the car in the house. How'd you lose the car in the house?
No, I catch myself saying, you know, we lost my dad a couple of years ago. Hell no, we didn't lose him. We know right where he is. You know, that's the torment of the language.
Yes.
We can't speak frank. And, you know, George Carlin said some of it. The guy James ran a clip where he was talking about this. He said, you know, I'm not going to pass on. I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to be lost. They're going to know right where to find me.
That's right.
So, yeah, this is, it's all part of a mind game that is directed at keeping the American people from confronting the reality of all of this stuff. You know, I've got a sound clip I'll probably play out at the top of the hour after what we've been talking about of Ed Schultz, for not exactly what I call a liberal, but him dealing with this right-wing thug Cliff May on Anderson Cooper, I guess, last Friday night.
Yeah, I heard that.
And I think it bears playing, because the Ed plays right into the right-wing frame, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's something we got to learn to get away from, because, you know, this business of defining, well, tell me how we're going to win in Iraq if all the troops are gone.
Yeah.
Oh, gee, I didn't realize it was a baseball game.
Well, exactly. Well, what's, you know, and I remember he did ask, well, what constitutes winning? You know, what does constitute winning? I mean, we just like in Vietnam, there's no objective. It's the objective to take the city and hold it. You know, and it's actually kind of funny. I just kind of want, you know, how I like to think strategically and, you know, militarily strategically. And I sit there and I look at what's going on right now. We're in Afghanistan. You know, a little bit, but we're also in Iraq. Hey, Bob, let's pretend we had the same kind of thing going on over here. And you're in Afghanistan, and me in Wisconsin, here I am out in Iraq, okay? And we sit here and we're talking. You don't think that they can talk? You don't think that they have a little way to talk to each other? And I'll say, all right, Bob, I've been getting my butt beat for a little bit, and it's time for you to start amping it up. You start amping it up, and you bring them out over there, and as soon as they sit there and they focus their eyes over there, I'll start on again over here. And this is guerrilla conflict. This is this thing that I don't understand why they can't comprehend this, but this is exactly where we're at. There is no winning. You cannot win. You can never win. I mean, even if you... I mean,
you can't... That's what I'd love to see somebody say to one of these right-wingers. You know, I'll tell you how to win in Iraq as soon as you tell me when you lost it.
There you go.
Because the damn thing was lost the minute that George Bush said fire back in March of 2003. And for the most part, this is how it turns out with wars of aggression. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If whoever starts it generally loses it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the history is chock full. chock full of examples.
Amen.
You start it, you're going to lose it.
Amen. We sit in there and listen. I mean, you and I are, you know, and the people that listen and have some sort of historical precedent and understand history. We understand that history is a lot longer than this country's been around. You see, but we're a very small, well, I think we're a growing minority, but we're a real small minority in terms of really understanding history and how history impacts. But we've talked this before. People in Iraq, the people in Afghanistan, man, they have history that goes back a thousand years, thousands of years, okay, of history. They know. And this is where you guys sit there and think, what are we going to win for what? 5 minutes? 5 years? 10 years? What? A year? 100 years? Eventually. And I know 100 years is really short. We can't afford 100 years, Mr. McCain. You know, when we say, hey, look, we cannot afford to do this for very much longer. And we couldn't afford to do this to begin with if you really want to get down to it. Okay, because as you know, the injection that the economy gets from wars like this is like nitrous in an engine. You know, it's a quick burn, boom, and then it's gone. And then what do you got? You're going to keep putting nitrous in your engine. You're going to seize up your pistons. You're going to melt that engine block. You're going to kill them heads. And this is exactly what's happening right now. We're starting to see that the engine's starting to knock.
We're running the military into the ground.
Exactly. We're running the economy into the ground. We're running our infrastructure into the ground because nobody's taking care of it. You know, a little bit patch here and there, but patches don't last. You know, this is the thing that I just laugh because the way we live is not even sustainable. And then we sit here and look at this, you know, we don't fight war sustainably. We don't sit there and think sustainably. We don't even think sustainably. A Dexter documentary, if you do get a chance to watch it, I certainly recommend you do it. It's called Garbage Warrior. About the architect that builds those earth ships. Really, really interesting stuff. Really good. Really, really good. Check it out. Watch what he did. He went down to India and helped them after the tsunami, you know, and built these ships out of plastic and tires. And, yeah, man, they're just beautiful little houses. Yeah, they're little mud houses, but, man, they're practical. They do their water. They have this. They have all this stuff. And, you see, you think about it. Are we in this, Bob? This is life. Here we are. You and I only get a little bit of a window. Are we in this for the short term, or are we in this for the long term? When we talk about war and this war of aggression that we've done, there's no way we can sustain this for a long term. And if we don't sustain it for the long term, we're going to lose. It's just mathematics. It's just reality. This is just how it is. We can't sit there and do
this. But at some point, Albert, we have to explain to these right-wing freaks that it's not about winning. We can't win. No. We've already lost.
Yeah. No doubt. It's like the minute you killed somebody. If you murder somebody, you're Bob Berdello or Jeffrey Dahmer, one of these serial killers. You're not a serial killer until you killed your first victim. And once that split-second moment that you did that, now you're a serial killer. Now you're a rapist. And once we went into Iraq, well, now what are we? Now we're on the same terms. This is, you know, I was saying, you can't call us Nazis. If you look like a Nazi, with the, you know, even our little helmets are reminiscent of that. If you look like a Nazi and act like a Nazi, well, how can you try to cry about being called a Nazi? What did the Nazis do that was so horrible? Besides the Holocaust, and you know I'm not going to get to that. But what did they do? They committed a war of aggression. Whoa! The crimes against peace! What have we done? How do you sit there? What's the double standard? How does this double standard even float? This is they talk about laws of physics over here. You can't sit there and defeat this. It's like, man, this stuff cannot run forever. This is not a perpetual engine. It's not built for sustainability. And you know, yeah, you're showing us a magic trick for 5-10 years, but man, they're just literally sucking this country dry. And we cannot sit here and fight people who have a long tooth of history. You know, 1,000 years, man. They know who their 30th uncle was and their ancestors, and they know this kind of stuff, man. This is how they live. We can't sit there and go against people like that unjustly and think that we can actually win and prevail. We can't prevail. I mean, you talk about karma. Even karmatically we can't win. It's just, that's why we're having the situation we're at, because we were wrong to begin with. And we're wrong now, and until we actually sit here and pull out, okay, say, I am sorry. We apologize for being completely on a roid rage and destroying your country.
And look, that's the only way that Iraq can come out of this with any semblance of wholeness, cohesion, and that is for a multinational peacekeeping force that does not in any way involve the United States to go in and do with Iraq what largely was done with Bosnia and Serbia and Herzegovina. And establish, you know, no fire zones, and separate people until they are willing to live together in peace.
Certainly, I mean, and that'll be, I mean, and not even
some Arabic going. Some Arabic speakers would be handy in this.
It would. It really would. It was actually kind of, you know, it's actually kind of interesting. I was my wife and I were watching Casablanca yesterday, last night, and you know how in the beginning they have this map of the world.
Well, if you ever it's one of my favorite movies, yes.
It is. It's a fantastic movie. It's just, you know, I couldn't, you know, it's so dirty in a way. But, you know, it's funny how words and how they used to use them and have a lot, they had a lot of impact, almost to an R rating. But, without being the crassness that, you know, I have in my heart, can't help it. But, when you sit there and you look at the little world map that they had, and it would be interesting, now it makes you want to go look at world maps from back in the day. You know, back in the 20s and, you know, so on and so forth. But according to their map, Iraq stretched all the way to Israel. And that was very interesting to me. Because I sit there and I look, and you know that, you know, the Arabs, they have that Arab, you know, brotherhood type unity type thing that Americans feel. And honestly, seriously, you know, not to sit down, I mean, God, Bob, I'm so sick and tired of arming our enemies and then shooting at them like, you know, because they had a gun. But at the same time, you know, we really literally have to rise up all boats and make all these people, I mean, it's going to take Barack Obama, it's going to take someone even more progressive than him, but it's going to take somebody who's going to take this movement to literally help them fix themselves. It's because that's really, we can't, man. Our military is designed for that. Our military is designed to destroy. It's not designed to help children or women. It's not designed to, you know, help an economy. It's designed to go in, lock down, and destroy. That's what we do, and that's what they do, and that's why when they sit there and they try, we're not peacekeepers. We're warriors. We're destroyers. So we've done that. We've destroyed the country how many other times, and you know what? Have you heard any reports? They're still running generators out there. Why? They don't have electricity. Oh, they still got sewage in the streets. Why? Because we bombed their sewage stations. Worms in the water. This and
yeah, all of which, by the way, are violations of the Articles of War. But never mind, you know.
You see, and this is where
we don't read articles.
Who has to hold them accountable? We do. You do. I do. Everyone listening to this, we have to hold ourselves accountable. I love how the Republicans talk about personal responsibility. What? Personal responsibility. Look, I mean, this is the thing. You got to look at what you've done. Personal responsibility. My foot. They talk about personal responsibility. This is, God, these people. Anyway.
I know.
Winning is putting food on the table. Winning is educating them. You know, winning is saying, I'm sorry. Winning is saying, I love you, and we're sorry we did this. Winning is sitting there, and, you know, it's defeat in the eyes of the guys that hold up signs that they can't even spell the words, right, that they're trying to communicate to other people. You know, but
frankly, winning is achieving, one way or another, the same attitude toward the United States that Vietnam manifests now. You know, you ask, I'm told, or I read somewhere, that, you know, you say something nice about the Chinese to a Vietnamese, he's liable to backhand you. Russians? Nah. You say you're an American? Hey, buddy, come on, you know. Let's go get a bombie bar, you know. Go get a beer.
I think because, well, and you got also the Vietnamese also have a long history too, and I said, so I think that makes it easier. It makes it easier for us to say face. It makes us easy. It makes it easier for us. You know, if we do it, you know, it's like, you know, it's almost like the, you know, these other countries are almost like the woman that'll forgive you no matter what. And being that is the case, we literally just have to ask for the forgiveness. We seriously just have to say, we're sorry. We have done wrong and we'd like to help you fix it. How do you think we should do that? You know, we're just the control freaks. You know, that's the other problem. You know, we're just control freaks. We feel like we have to control. We feel like we have the answers. And, you know, I don't know how many times you can slap your head against the wall before you realize, man, I'm slapping my head against the wall. I got to stop. Yeah, I got to sit here and literally, you know, sometimes it helps to ask, you know, sometimes when you're doing a puzzle, it helps when somebody comes up and Agnes goes, hey, Bob's doing a puzzle. You can't get any more pieces than 20. And Agnes comes in, boom, 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 and she helps you lay out the edge. You know, and that's, you know, people, we, I don't know why we, there's another thing. Why do Americans have such a problem asking for help?
That's the nice thing about banging your head against the wall, Albert. It feels so good when you stop. I'm going to roll on here, brother. Thanks for, you've set up the rest of the program for a whole bunch of other stuff. So, you know, thank you very kindly.
Oh,
and are the sugar snap peas still in the garden, or have the girls gone through all of them?
The girls have gone through half of them, and there's a little critter. I don't know what it is, but there is a critter. I've been looking for him, and he's out there, and he's getting them up real high. I don't know. He must be a flying squirrel or a flying rabbit or something.
Birds?
But, yeah, other than that, everything else is looking really good.
Cool.
I just can't wait till it starts giving me some eggplants and tomatoes. And,
oh, tomatoes. I had to buy one of those styromatoes at the store the other day, and I just said, I can't wait until I can at least bum a couple of tomatoes off of a neighbor.
Amen. All right, Bob.
All right, take care, Albert.
Right, bye
now. It's our buddy Albert in Wisconsin, a man of many ideas. And we will delve into a few other ideas when we come back, take a little break. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. Thank you to those of you who have stepped up and become new participants in Conversation Radio, and thank you to those of you who have been for quite some time. You're making Conversation Radio possible right here on the Horn.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
All right, then, a little late starting the second hour, but that's okay. This is Conversation Radio, and we're not particularly obsessed with clocks. A little update for you. A little ditty that I wrote and John Fox performed and recorded. The pastor from Montgomery is getting kind of viral. It went from us to Loretta Knoll. Loretta put a video to it, and it made its way over to Pam's Houseplant and Pam Spaulding. Now it's found its way all the way to Jesus General, patriotboy.blogspot.com. Very cool. Very cool. Tickles me pink, and I know it does John, too. And, you know, who knows what it may inspire as soon as both of us have some, you know, just spare time laying around that we're doing nothing with. There, you know, we get together on the horn section. If you haven't heard the horn section, you really haven't lived. The horn section, when Peter Godbold and John Fox and I, or just Peter and John, or Peter and John and Agnes, or John and me, or get together about 11 p.m. weekday evenings, mostly. And just sort of free form, and you know, usually the two or three ideas for a song parody come out at least every week. It's terrifying in terms of the workload that just being a parodist could wind up being. But you know, that's neither here nor there. Let's see, places to go. One quick, you know, we ride pretty close herd on the sickos of the right wing, whether it's Flimball or the Savage Wiener or the Hannity Job, the life support system for a haircut, or God knows Falafel Boy O'Reilly. But you want to know who's even meaner about it? Cattier? Flush Flimball himself. You know, there was this article that talked about, you know, the 24,000 square foot mansion he lives in with a cat and his big painting of himself on black velvet with the dogs playing poker and the bullfighter and Elvis in the background. But further in the article, he starts dissing on his fellow conservatives. With regard to the Savage Wiener, he says, he's not even in my rearview mirror, my friends. And he said that Hannity Job, the life support system for a haircut, who may be getting a job with Premier Radio Networks, which is the syndication arm, if you didn't know, of Clear Channel, says that he feels about Hannity the way Muhammad Ali felt about Jimmy Ellis, who was a former sparring partner turned challenger. Talking about Hannity Job, Flimball said, I have no competitors. Hannity isn't even close to me. Rumors that the Hannity Job will ink a $20 million or so deal. Just $20 million. But the best one of all, they also asked him about Falafel Boy O'Reilly. And, you know, when Falafel Boy read this, it had to really, really, really hurt. It had to sting. It had to burn. They asked Flimball about O'Reilly, and Flimball answered, somebody's got to say it. The man is Ted Baxter. No kidding. Flush Flimball called Bill O'Reilly Ted Baxter. And for the first time in recorded history, on that isolated particular point, I am in complete 100% agreement with Flush Flimball. And just having those words come out of my mouth makes me want to stop the show right now and just dive headlong into a swimming pool filled with Clorox. But Bill O'Reilly is Ted Baxter. Now, of course, Flush Flimball couldn't be bothered to come up with anything original because he got that line by virtue of the fact that Keith Olbermann has been, when he does his so-called impression of O'Reilly, he's doing a bad impression, of course, of Ted Baxter. Just like when Limbaugh says, I'm having more fun than most, my friends, I'm having more fun than most human beings should be allowed to have. That's a stolen line, too. He stole that from David Letterman. He's never had an original idea in his life. I forget what the name of the website is, but you can go back, you know, you can use the Google, because unlike John McCain, you know how to use a computer. And you can use the Google and just Google up Jeff Christie, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-E, and, you know, get a liquor bottle, a bottle of liquor and a straw or whatever will, you know, just keep you off the ledge. And you can listen to Flush Flimball's old air check back when he was cruising the gay neighborhoods of Pittsburgh as Jeff Christie. And you'll hear all the same old tired stuff, that he's the same shtick that he's doing today. Amazing, just amazing. Somebody's got to say it. The man is Ted Baxter. I don't even think liberal talkers are as rough on each other as that. But nobody has that monumental, undeservedly huge ego that Flush Flimball has. What is he, 27 cars and a Gulfstream jet? Somebody's compensating! But to get back to something that I was talking with Albert about, this business with Ed Schultz and Cliff May. Cliff May is, of course, just, I'd say he's a pig, but that'd be really too mean to the pig. But he is. He had an exchange on Anderson Cooper 360. By the way, if you want to catch the rerun later tonight after the Horn stream has gone to reruns, Anderson Cooper 360 will be featuring Mikey Weinstein from the Military Religious Freedom Foundation talking about the fundamentalization of the United States military this evening. I'm going to have to catch it online. That's what you can do. Just, you know, catch it online. It'll be excerpted, I'm sure. So, on Anderson Cooper 360, on the 4th of July, Cliff May tried that same old tired crap about how, well, you know, you're a liberal, you're a cheese-eating surrender monkey. You know what I mean? Just check this out for a minute.
Yeah, and I think also on some of the more left-wing blogs, Obama is taking some hits. But this does move him to the center. I'm not a big fan of his, but I'm going to put the best spin on it, which is that he understands the situation fairly well, certainly better than the Daily Kos does and some of those on the left who would like to see America defeated in Iraq as a demonstration exercise
that U.S. power never can be used for good. That is absolutely outrageous. That is outrageous for you to say that people on the left want to lose in Iraq. I'm not going to sit here and listen to that. This is the 4th of July. We are Americans. We don't believe in fighting in Iraq the way we are doing. We're depleting our resources. That's ridiculous.
Well, Ed, tell me how you're going to win in Iraq.
That is absolutely ridiculous.
Ed, just tell me how you're going to win in Iraq if you have no troops there.
You don't even know what the definition of win is.
Tell me the definition of win. If I don't know it, you tell me.
We don't have enough money to do this. We are absolutely hurting ourselves staying in Iraq. The Iraqi people need to step up. The real enemy here.
And there's my problem with that exchange. The Iraqi people need to step up. The Iraqi people need to step up. Talk about a blame the victim mentality. Kind of hard to step up when your legs have been blown off now, isn't it? When are we going to stop playing these footsie games with the right wing? You don't even know what the definition of win is. Ed, buddy, Iraq cannot be won. This is what Albert and I were talking about. Iraq cannot be won. You cannot win, first of all, you cannot win an occupation. Second of all, you cannot win a war that you've already lost. The South proves that every time that, you know, like the 4th of July rolls around and people in Vicksburg have to still remember the siege of that city on the Mississippi River. Or the 4th of July rolls around and the scholars, sons of the Confederate veterans, get out and start talking about how maybe the South could have won at Gettysburg if but for however. You can't win in reverse. This is the one instance where you cannot snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. Because countries that start wars lose wars. Period. There are very few historical examples of countries starting wars and winning wars. Countries initiating the first hostilities and ultimately prevailing. Very few examples throughout history. Athens started the war with Sparta after some wrangling back and forth and some feints and some parries and some thrusts. Athens finally, with the Delian League, started the war with Sparta, the Peloponnesian War. And guess what? 30 years later, Athens surrendered to Sparta. And thus came an end to Athenian democracy. The Punic Wars? Hannibal crossed the Mediterranean from Africa to Spain, marched from Spain up around and down the Alps and down the spine of Italy, and lost, even though he had elephants. Over and over and over again, countries that start wars lose wars. Who fired on Fort Sumter? That did just checking. They lost. Who bombed Pearl Harbor? They lost. Even if you take the semi-dodgy little example of the Saddam and Iraq and Kuwait. Who marched into Kuwait? Who lost? Who marched into Iraq? Who's going to lose? Who marched into Afghanistan? Soviet Union. Who lost? The Soviet Union. Vietnam? Mm-hmm. You couldn't exactly call what we did in Korea a victory. That's still just a truce. No peace treaty. No end to hostilities. On and on and on and on. But you see, if you say that we lost, then the right wing says, that's the way you want to portray it. Portray hell. It's just reality. It is what it is. But that business about the Iraqis need to step up just makes me crazy. The idea that it is Iraq's fault for being a mess. It isn't. And newsflash, it's not Al-Qaeda in Iraq's fault either. It's our fault. All liability is based on fault. And it is our fault that Iraq is the way that it is. And there's no better way to do Iraq. There isn't a better military strategy that will suddenly turn the tables in Iraq. It's lost. We were beaten the minute we dropped the first bomb. Shock and awe in the night over Baghdad was nothing but the fireworks show ahead of the finale, and the finale has taken 5+ years to complete. We lost in March of 2003. In May of 2003, when that beady-eyed, pig-eyed, jug-eared little lout stood on that aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, and said, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. We had already lost. For those of you keeping score at home, we've also lost Afghanistan. We lost it when we started it, too. Because, don't tell anybody, but Afghanistan did not attack us on September 11th. A non-state actor attacked us on September 11th, 2001. And the way you deal with non-state actors is more law enforcement than it is military action. Oh, you might use some special forces squads and so forth. But you don't swat flies with sledgehammers. That way leads slapstick. The only problem is nobody's laughing. Nobody's laughing. Except perhaps the defense contractors, and the fat cats at the Pentagon, and the war-supporting, troop-supporting members of the Grand Hypocrisy Party. Great example of that, by the way. A congressman by the name of Representative Mike Turner, a repig-licking from the state of Ohio. On May the 15th, Representative Mike Turner, upstanding patriotic conservative American, voted against the GI Bill that had been put forward by Senator Jim Webb. Now, if you follow this program and or if you follow the news, you know that a week or so ago, George Bush tried to give credit to John McCain for that bill, even though John McCain opposed it at every turn. You know that. You might, however, be surprised, knowing, as I've just told you, that Representative Mike Turner, the pig-licking of Ohio, you might be surprised to know that after he, well, it's kind of like what they used to say in 2004, he was against it before he was for it, this GI Bill. He voted against the GI Bill and then turned around and wrote an op-ed piece in his hometown newspaper. What was he doing? Was he excoriating the tax and spend liberal policies of the Democrat Party? You know how that did. Yeah. No! After voting against the GI Bill that had been proposed and fought for by Senator Webb, after voting against it, Representative Mike Turner, repig-licking of Ohio, went home to his knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing faithful and penned an op-ed piece for his local newspaper claiming to have supported it. From that op-ed piece, the following. It is our responsibility to provide veterans with more than just recognitions for their service. We must also make certain that they have the skills they need to accomplish their next mission once they return to civilian life. That is why I was proud to support recently passed legislation that expanded the Montgomery GI Bill to provide more funding for veterans to receive a college education. With the huge impact the GI Bill has had on America and the debt that we all owe our nation's veterans in mind, I was proud to support recent legislation that dramatically expanded the scope and scale of the educational benefits available to our veterans. I'm wearing my flag pin as I write this. My hand is over my heart, and I am typing with only one hand. I am proud to have supported legislation that will directly provide this benefit for military families and look forward to further working on their behalf in the future. Wow. You want to talk about a loser? The Disabled American Veterans and Retired Enlisted Association both have given this guy, respectively, a 29% and 34% lifetime score. He gets a miserable C from the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans Association. But he's a repig-licking. And remember, I-O-K-I-Y-A-R, it's okay if you're a Republican, Iakiar. And he's just counting on the fact that he's going to go home and lie to the folks at home. You know, I love that Mike Turner. I just love Mike Turner. Why, he supports our troops just like I do, just like I did when I put that Chinese yellow ribbon magnet on the back of my gas-guzzling SUV. Yes, sir, we support the troops, and we're damn proud of it. And those evil Democrats, why, they're trying to lose in Iraq. Yeah, this appeared in the Times-Gazette of Hillsboro, Ohio. Oh, it's a sickening piece of smarmy pandering. Turner is from Centerville, Ohio. He's the representative from Ohio's 3rd Congressional District. I don't know enough about Ohio to know where Centerville is. However, two people have called him on his lies. I'm going to the phone just in a second here. One writer commented on the online version of this story. I hate to point out that there's a thing called the Internet. On the Internet, there's a website dedicated to Congress. On that very same website, you're shown as voting nay for the legislation you claim to have supported. Representative Turner, another comment. You voted against the bill you now claim to have supported. I took the time to check the congressional records again this morning. Repiglickens. The truth ain't in 'em. One wonders if this creep has any sort of credible opposition. And one certainly hopes that he does. To the phones. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Juanita.
Hey, Juanita, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
You know, I had a wonderful weekend, and I'm excited to be back behind the mic on a Monday evening.
That's great. Welcome back.
Well, thank you.
One a couple of things I wanted to talk about. Heard something interesting on The View today.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. First thing off, Barbara Walters had gone to Syria. She's back. And she was with the president.
We couldn't get the Syrians to keep her?
She spent, you know, like a big meal with them about over an hour, and then she spent time with them, and she said that everything was totally different than she was expecting. And she said that she didn't go under the, you know, from ABC, but she went, someone just suddenly asked her if she would want to go, and she said yes. And she said that his wife was educated here in this country, and she's got schools where she's trying to teach the little kids, you know, how to get in their own business. And she said just, she felt, she said, now, I know I don't know, everything about, but she said that I feel like we should get to know these people. And she was talking about they got a lot of Iraqis, you know, that we haven't accepted.
Yeah. Well, there's a million dead Iraqis, Juanita, and there's 2 million Iraqis who have had to flee Iraq, including the vast majority of what had once been a vibrant Christian community.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. And then I was just absolutely thrilled to see Bush being all what he is, among other things.
You mean on the 4th of July, or?
Well, on the 4th of July and on at Jefferson's Monticello.
Yeah, that was the 4th of July at Monticello.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
I thought it was when people were becoming citizens.
Well, that was a citizenship ceremony at Monticello.
Oh, okay. I guess I meant.
Well, yeah, where they heckled him, and then Bush said, here in America we have freedom of speech. Now arrest those people.
Yeah, but we'll drive you away if you dare to say it. That's what somebody made a comment. I thought that was pretty good. But anyway.
Well, he was George was booed. George was booed and protested at Monticello, Richard B. Dick, big time Five Deaf Cheney, was booed in Boston.
Good.
He had the nerve to show up aboard the United States' oldest commissioned vessel, the USS Constitution.
Well, they have no shame.
No, they haven't.
They just don't. I mean, I've seen people like that all through my life, but not to that extent. Absolutely not. That's basically what I wanted to say.
Well, hopefully some of, you know, it's like Albert says, he's hopeful. Hopefully some of the American people are beginning to figure, you know, granted, we're a day late and a dollar short on figuring it out about George Bush and Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
But if we can transfer that and understand that John McCain is more of the same, then maybe if nothing else, we get a little bit of breathing room, Juanita.
I know, we need it. Every time you think you can breathe easily, if something's shoved down so the water boards you spiritually again.
It's a constant struggle, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is your internet behaving again?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've been acting off and on. In fact, I thought it was completely gone the other day. And I thought, well, I'll just have to wait till, you know, till they come out, because they couldn't come out until tomorrow. But all of a sudden at night, started working. And it works off and on. And Saturday it worked all day long, so I don't know.
Well, cross your fingers.
But they're coming out tomorrow morning.
And by the way, it was you who sent me that address by Robert Kennedy, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
That was beautiful, Juanita.
Yes, it was.
And what a brilliant thing to be pointed out, that much as I can't remember where it showed up, but it was an address by Robert Kennedy Jr. pointing out that once upon a time, 200 years ago, Britain faced the challenge of ending all commerce with slavery. And that certain people stood up in Parliament and said, oh, the economy will crash. It'll be our economic destruction.
Yeah.
And he points out the parallels with getting serious about hydrocarbons and carbons in the atmosphere and the same fear-mongering that's done by the chattering moneyed class today. Oh, wow, you know, if we try to reduce our carbon emissions, it'll end business as we know it.
Yeah.
It's just another lie.
That's one time when I was studying metaphysics at one time, I was interested in that he gave me a lot to think about, that like when we had horses and then the horseless, you know, buggy came along and people said, and that we're in the horse business, said, what are we going to do? You know, and then the whaling industry and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We have a can-do nation if we're allowed to.
Right. As long, if the Republicans and the right-wingers and the conservatives would quit telling us what a bunch of losers we are, we could figure out a lot of stuff.
Oh, and you know they've done it since he started in office, you know. Saying,
sure.
I hope they will... not act up, you know.
Right.
And then our people, you know, oh, we want to do anything we can to help you. But they just don't give it the credit because they don't know how to appreciate it.
Well, Juanita, I hear the beeping of your phone in the background, and I don't know what that is.
Maybe it's dead.
Yeah, I fear that your phone is about to run out of battery.
Okay. Okay, and you have a good night.
All right. You take care, Juanita.
Okie doke.
Thanks for the
Bye-bye.
View update.
Okay.
Bye now. Juanita watches The View, so you don't have to. Sorry, that was a smart alecky comment of me. Yeah. Barbara Walters went to Syria, and we couldn't get him to keep her? I should learn. So, onward. There is, it's not all, well, I mentioned something to Albert in the last hour that bears fleshing out. I don't know if you're following it, but this story comes from Stars and Stripes, by the way. Headline, contractors oppose move to end immunity from Iraqi law. This is a real sick one. Because, after all, The mercenaries are there in Iraq, the old apartheid knee busters and the right-wing death squad members from Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador, as well as some bad actors from the United States. They're there to help Iraq. They're there to do good works for the Iraqi people. You know, good works like gunning down automobiles from a tail gun on a Hummer, that kind of stuff. You know, just shooting at cars to watch them take out the telephone poles. Yeah, good fun. Good, clean fun. And they are having a snit. They are having an absolute conniption right now. I mean, the mercenaries are having kittens with crocheted tails. Contractors working for the U.S. military in Iraq. Let's try that again. Mercenaries in Iraq say a move to end their immunity from Iraqi law would make many leave their jobs instead of face a justice system they do not trust. Now, what were we just saying about the doom and gloom scenarios constantly trotted out by the fear-mongering right wing? Why, we can't do away with the mercenaries in Iraq. Well, then we'll lose. See how it works? Earlier this week, the Iraqi foreign minister, Hoshar Zebari, said the immunity issue was one of the American concessions made in ongoing negotiations over a long-term security agreement. By the way, this is the security agreement that actually has to be ratified by the Iraqi parliament, but the Bush administration says doesn't have to be ratified by the Senate or the House or either house of the United States Congress, that they'll just do it as an executive order with a little signing statement, a finding by the executive, and, you know, then everything's good. Since the announcement, contractors, both current and former workers in Iraq, have been buzzing about its implications. Actually, that buzzing sound, never mind. There are an estimated 180,000 foreign contractors. There are an estimated 180,000 foreign mercenaries working in Iraq, more than there are U.S. troops in the country. More than 1,000 have been killed. Quote, having worked for 2 years and 2 months in Iraq, I can tell you without a doubt I would in no way work if I fell under Iraqi law, a deputy sheriff who trains Iraqi police said in an email to Stars and Stripes. Are you kidding? You wouldn't be able to get but the most desperate people to work if they fell under their ridiculous laws. Oddly enough, however, as I pointed out last week, I believe it's Blackwater that's arguing that those ridiculous laws should obtain in regard to suits brought by people who were slaughtered by the mercenaries in federal court. Really. Like almost all contractors working in Iraq, he's not allowed to do media interviews without approval from his company, so he asked that his name not be used. Another contractor said, I would immediately have to consider my options concerning leaving this country. They, the Iraqis, cannot rule themselves, and now they want to try and rule contractors. Lock and load! No, sorry, the lock and load was my ad. I am confident if all security contract members stick to their drills and follow the rules of engagement as laid down by the U.S. military or respective companies as... Oh, Lordy. And follow the rules of engagement as laid down by the U.S. military or respective companies, there shouldn't be a problem in the near future, one private mercenary said. Well, that's redundant. One mercenary said. This is, how about that? Our soldiers at least, and Marines, our military has to at least behave within a sort of de minimis interpretation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The contractors, the mercenaries, the Blackwater and CACI types, laws? We don't need stinking laws. We're here for the money. We're here for the fun. And we'll shoot you if you get in the way. Blackwater officials declined comment this week on the reported immunity negotiations. They said they'd wait until agreement's announced, and the new agreement has to be reached before December when the UN mandate under which U.S. forces currently work expires. Well, howdy-do when the UN mandate under which U.S. forces currently work expires. So the UN mandate's going to expire in December, and after that, what? After that, we're just a rogue nation occupying another sovereign state. One mercenary said, we do not ask for much. We don't expect welcome home banners or medals or even a pat on the back. We get paid, right? This is Jacko Boats, who's a mercenary who's been in Iraq for 4 years. Why, he founded himself a little organization, the International Contractors Association. International Mercenaries Association. What I expect is to be acknowledged as an important part of the whole effort to bring peace and stability to this region. In my mind, this is a package deal. By taking away contractor immunity, contractors are being marked as expendable assets. Assets that will be placed in the hands of a very shaky and corrupt law system. Really? You don't want to be treated as expendable, Jacko? You don't? In other words, you don't want to be treated like a member of the United States military is treated? You don't want to just go home with your mind shattered and be left to fend for yourself, Jacko? The International Contractors Association seeks to dispel the notion that the profession, suddenly they're architects or doctors or lawyers, that the profession is a bed of dollar bills. Hell no, it's not a bed of dollar bills. It's a bloomin' mattress factory of dollar bills. 100 large a year? Well, it's not all shooting the Hodgies and having fun. Sometimes they shoot back. 1,000 mercenaries have... Pardon me? What are we up to in American military fatalities, the ones that we actually bother to count? We're past 4,000? And yet there are more mercenaries in Iraq than there are American soldiers and Marines. Funny. I can't seem to make that add up. How about you? Assets that will be placed in the hands of a very shaky and corrupt law system. Jacko, come on home, buddy. We can show you a shaky and corrupt law system if you want to see one. Because we're just swimming in it. Jacko said in the past week that a vast majority of the group's 2,500 members, he's got 2,500 members out of 180,000 people there, would think seriously about leaving Iraq if the immunity deal is cemented. The Stars and Stripes article notes that debate over the status of contractors peaked last year when guards with the Blackwater Security Company allegedly shot and killed 17 people in a Baghdad incident. Iraqi officials say the guards shot indiscriminately. Blackwater officials have said their guards came under attack. Yeah. Then there are the other stories, like the Blackwater mercenaries who held American soldiers at gunpoint, face down. The soldiers, not the mercenaries. The soldiers were face down with guns pointed at their heads. Hoo-wee. Just makes me want to stand up and put my hand over my flag pin and get all patriotic when I think about the mercenaries in Iraq. We don't expect welcome home banners or medals or even a pat on the back. My heart's breaking. $75,000 a year, $100,000 a year, $150,000 a year. That's plenty enough back padding as far as I'm concerned. Right? Yeah. Ah, brother. But they're going, they may have to leave if they're actually subjected to a system of justice. Because they're not, that's the trick, not subject to a system of justice as it now stands. Amazing. And to see this story come up on Stars and Stripes is, I just gotta wonder what kind of sympathy this engenders in the United States military. I can't imagine that it engenders too terribly much. So that's our number, holy cow, our number two? Wow, where does the time go? It goes somewhere. Fortunately, actually, it goes into the archives right here. On the Horn, America's liberal voice, listener supported. We'll be back.
They talk about the women too much. The women got so confused. They don't talk about their lives as such. My life is all I got to lose. They take it with a grain of salt and laugh at the complexities. They're good at picking all the faults. I keep laughing so they don't pick me. Jesus, if I had to quit tonight, panic in the gray room.
tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Almost 2 minutes past the hour. And we can take the program just about anywhere you want it to go. And I've got some stories that I think are worth keeping up with from some other fronts during this final hour as well. I just heard, by the way, I just heard from Peter Gottbold. No live Strictly Confidential this evening. He is still in internet hell. To describe, you don't want to be on the wrong side of Peter Gottbold when he gets angry. And he's really angry right now. Not at you guys, not at me. No, but that little sort of fly-by-night internet operation that brings him his service. And I don't blame him. Even his day job, he's got to have a good internet connection. And this is crippling to him. And I don't know if I'd be responsible for my temper if I was in the position he's in right now. So I frequently talk about what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. But it's what mountaintop removal is doing to Appalachia and doing to the rest of the country, being as how we're all downstream. And I've got one here from our sister state, or actually not our sister state, our mother state of Virginia. And it's made particularly sad because the bad actor in this story is someone that a lot of Democrats had pinned a lot of hopes on. I've actually met the guy. It's Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia, a Democrat. And at the same time that a court in Georgia recently stopped a multi-billion-dollar coal-fired, filthy, no carbon sequestration, no carbon capture, old technology power plant. At the same time that Georgia did that, Georgia, for heaven's sakes, Tim Kaine, the Democratic governor of Virginia, who has received $88,000 from a company called Dominion Energy in the recent past, just told Southwestern Virginia to go chini itself. Let's check in on a little bit of audio here. Something from something touching upon what just got done to West Virginia, or to Western Virginia. On June 30th, Dominion Virginia Power announced that construction has already begun. And it's the same scene you see. It's the same scene that you see in southern West Virginia. Coal cars on trains carrying the wealth of a region away for shipment to China. Coal trucks destroying roads and pouring dust into the air. Coal-fired power plants. But you also see something that is exciting. Listen.
As a supposed solution to Virginia's energy needs.
I think we've been pretty much deemed expendable.
Regardless of what is said in that building today, know you are right. We have already won.
This decision by Dominion Virginia Power, with the blessing of Tim Kaine, to go ahead with construction is a reckless decision.
The government has not represented our views. They've represented the views of corporate interests.
Asthma is on the rise. No, we are poisoning our children.
We love our children, even if they don't. We love our communities and our people, even if they don't.
You know, they take it for granted that they can just do whatever they want to do.
But you cannot come in and just poison us without protest.
Yeah. Dominion says that this plant is needed for them to meet the energy needs of Northern Virginia.
Northern and Eastern Virginia, not us, not where it's coming from.
We always get the most pollution for the energy needs of Northern Virginia and the big industrial cities.
On an unusually hot June day in 1988, NASA climate scientist James Hansen told Congress the Earth was warming and humans, not natural cycles, were responsible. Hansen changed the debate.
The only way we're going to keep climate within a reasonable range is if we phase out use of coal.
Washingtonian Magazine, in its annual Green issue, named Tim Kaine as one of the 10 biggest enemies of the environment in this region because he supports the new coal plant in Wise County, Virginia.
If you want to reduce greenhouse gases, there are some who say you can't build any more coal plants, and I don't agree with that.
It does require that we have a moratorium on any new coal-fired power plants, and over the next 25 to 30 years, we're going to have to phase out those that exist. So it is just silly to build a new one now.
But within a 48-hour period, America's most famous climate scientist said, we cannot build one more new coal-fired power plant. And the state of Virginia said, no, we're going to do it anyway.
I don't believe that the solution going forward is a no-coal solution.
Clean coal is not a reality. False solutions such as nuclear and clean coal cannot be employed.
So you're looking at 2 to 5 times the cost to build new plants as opposed to design the current system more efficiently.
Only renewable energy, true renewable energy such as wind, solar, conservation, and energy efficiency need to be employed.
We're 7 and 8s as far as, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10. We could put turbines in, and I'd much rather see a wind turbine up here than look at that every day.
So here it can be rate pay. A homeowner or a renter who just turns on a light switch and has a bill that comes from the Dominion Power, your rates will go up to build the power plant.
They didn't go far enough, and so we'll just have to push on.
The construction of the coal-fired power plant sequesters no carbon, nothing, began on June 30. This is the audio from a brilliant, wonderful piece of videography done by the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, cleanenergyva.org is the website. cleanenergyva.org. And I just wanted to share that with you because I feel a definite kinship with these people. They're in the same fight that we are. They're in the same fight that Coal River Mountain Watch is in. They're in the same fight that the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition is in. They're in the same fight that all of us who are interested in having an actual future to hand on to our children, our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, generations as yet undreamt of, we're all standing shoulder to shoulder in the same fight. Like I said, I was changed by just with my naked eye, not a picture, not a video, but with my bare naked eye looking out on the moonscape that's been created on the mountains where Larry Gibson's people have been inhabitants for three centuries. And so when I see folks standing up in Virginia, I know that we're standing up in the same fight. And I hope that they know somehow. I hope that word gets to them that here in the hills and hollers of West Virginia, by God, we've got their back. Because we're all saying the same thing. Do you hear that? I'd rather see wind turbines up there than look at this. And the look at this was yet another blighted, cancerous scar on a beautiful, beautiful piece of Appalachia. Oh, by the way, the air quality permits for Dominion Virginia Power that allowed the filthy coal-fired power plant to go forward, those permits were issued, of course, by the Virginia Air Pollution Control Board. The vote was unanimous. The board had been recently appointed by Tim Kaine, who had in turn recently received $88,000 from Virginia Dominion Energy. You know, we used to call that's since 2002, $88,000. We used to call that bribery. But now we just call it politics as usual. Thirteen people were arrested blockading the entrance to Dominion's headquarters in Richmond. Good on them. They may not know it, but I'm their friend. We're their friend. And we're proud of them for having the guts to stand up. So that's just one thing that begged to mention this evening. We have to stand shoulder to shoulder and not let them bully or bulldoze us. It's about a quarter past the hour. If you want to get in on the conversation, you know how to do so. The phone number is 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. That's toll-free on our nickel. If you want to do it on yours, it's 304-658-3333. And I hope you will if there's something burning you up. How about a little something from the giggle department? I mean, it's not, you know, this isn't the kicker for the end of the show. And, you know, and did you know he did it all with old coat hangers? No. But there's a sense of gratification in this. I'm no fan of the Disney empire. But I do love seeing the National Pig Lickin' Rifle Association get it stuck to them and broke off. This year, this very year, the state of Florida passed a law, you know, because Florida's a dangerous place. And it was done largely by Republicans with some Democratic connivance. They passed a law that says you can, well, the name of the law is the Preservation and Protection of the Right to Keep and Bear Arms in Motor Vehicles Act of 2008. Because, you know, that's what the Second Amendment says. A well-regulated militia being necessary to a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms in motor vehicles shall not be abridged. Yeah, the Preservation and Protection of the Right to Keep and Bear Arms in Motor Vehicles Act of 2008 was designed to make sure that anywhere Floridians went, they could take their darling gun with them. Hallelujah. Praise Jeebus. And it was meant to allow really, Floridians who didn't have felony raps or anything like that, to carry them their trusty shooting iron anywhere they went. And they got outsmarted by a rat. This thing went hustling through the Florida legislature, and it was a typical NRA effort. They're really pissed off right now, the National Republican Rifle Association. They've issued an alert that says, Disney thumbing nose at new Florida gun law. Disney is a prime offender when it comes to firing employees for exercising Second Amendment rights. Gee, guys, I had no idea that the Second Amendment had that motor vehicle language in it. But they have those special reading glasses at the National Republican Rifle Association, and they read it right into the Second Amendment. And what happened over the course of trying to ramrod this bill through the Florida legislature is that a couple of cooler heads prevailed, and a couple of folks looked up and said, guys, there are some places we just don't want Bubba and Billy Joe taking their shooting irons to. Like, for instance, a place that stores a lot of high explosives. And so some language got inserted into the bill that said that, if you've got high explosives and a permit for them, that you're exempted from the bill. That makes sense. Senator Darrell Peden, a panhandle repig licking. See, the panhandle, for those of you not nearby, the panhandle of Florida is every bit the redneck paradise that Georgia and Alabama are. And somebody told him about the law and the clause and Disney's position. He said, "You gotta be kidding me. I intended that exemption to exempt places like defense plants and Air Force bases and things like that, but not Disney, not at all." But sure enough, the law includes a clause that says that businesses are exempt with regard to, quote, property owned or leased by an employer who has obtained a permit under federal law for such explosives. And guess who has a permit for such explosives? That's right, the rat does. Disney does. Of course, you know, from my standpoint, I'm not inclined to take a Disney vacation in the first place. Well, why would you want to go to Europe, Bob? They got a replica of it right there at Disney World, and it's much cleaner, and they speak English. Disney has the permit, and Disney has said that it's all of its employees, all 60,000 of its employees, are not affected by the law allowing good God-fearing gun-toting Floridians to take their shooting arms to work. And Lordy, the wing nuts are about set to pee on themselves over it. Because when this bring them in your car bill was getting rammed through, Disney opposed it, the Florida Chamber of Commerce opposed it, the Florida Retail Federation opposed it, but the National Republican Rifle Association said, screw them, we want to go grocery shopping with our guns. You never know when you're going to be putting away your grocery bags and suddenly need to take your Tech 9 out and just spray down a gang of hoodlums. Disney said, and God, this one's another one that galls me, reasonably, that the that not allowing people to carry keep guns in their cars at work is a matter of protecting the safety of our cast and our guests. See, they call their employees their cast. Because it's all just one big show. But it looks like the National Pig, Lick, and Rifle Association and Representative Durrell Peden is going to have to eat it this time. And one other legislator said, I don't think anybody that voted for that bill expected Disney to be exempt. Disney? Disney has tons of high explosives on its property. You can't swing a dead cat without getting it caught in a fireworks extravaganza. Good God, Disney World announces breakfast with fireworks. It's like a war zone down there. Every time you turn around, something's exploding in air. And you gotta get just a little bit of visceral pleasure from seeing the National Pig, Lick, and Rifle Association lose one. Then don't get your hopes up. This doesn't mean that everything is safe in Florida. You just can't go to an Air Force base or a defense contractor or Disney World with a gun in your car. You can go to church with a gun in your car. You can go grocery shopping with a gun in your car. Go to the post office with a gun in your car. You can go to the doctor with a gun in your car. Go to the veterinarian with a gun in your car. You can go to visit old Aunt Mabel at the nursing home with a gun in your car. You can go to the neonatal unit of the nearby university hospital with a gun in your car. You can go golfing with a gun in your car. You can drive out to go scuba diving with a gun in your car. I fully expect the National Pig, Lick, and Rifle Association to start pushing a concealed carry for scuba divers permit soon, allowing guns to be taken underwater, because we all know that those spear guns just aren't nearly as effective as they ought to be underwater against such desperate terrorist threats as barracudas and sharks. I mean, we're talking about the National Pig, Lick, and Rifle Association. They're not real sharp. Oh, yeah, there's nowhere you can't go. If you're a homophobic redneck repiglickin', you can drive through the gay sections of cities with a gun in your car. If you're a racist, Klan-loving, redneck repiglickin' Floridian, you can drive through, oh, the black section of town with a gun in your car, or the Haitian section, or the Cuban section with a gun in your car. And you can feel threatened by every human being you see in that neighborhood. And you might just have to kill a few. Oh, yeah. You can go to Key West with a gun in your car. Shoot, you can probably get on a boat and leave Key West and go out to Fort Jefferson in the Dry Tortugas with a gun on the boat. There's nowhere you can't go, with the exception of Disney and defense contractors and an Air Force base in Florida with a gun in your car. I feel safer already, don't you? When I first read the story, it felt like a win. You can drive... I hate it when it gets personal. You can drive to the Florabama Lounge, the last great American roadhouse. You can drive to the Florabama Lounge as long as you stay on the Florida side with a gun in your car. Give Alabama another year. If they haven't done it already, you'll probably be able to cross the state line with that same gun in your car. So you drive to the Floribama Lounge. You go in. You have you a few icy cold long necks. Maybe you're there for the annual mullet toss contest. And maybe your favorite mullet tosser doesn't win. Well, you can go back to your car and get your gun and have words with the judges. Yes, sirree. Yes, sirree. You can drive down Alligator Alley with a gun in your car and maybe feel threatened by an alligator that's 50 feet away and blow him away. You can go to Joe's Stone Crab in Miami with a gun in your car. And God help the waiter or waitress if you don't get good service. I used to love to read those Carl Hiaasen Florida sort of crime novels. And to read Carl Hiaasen, pretty crazy place to begin with. Now it's going to be downright zany. All those guns in cars. Because if everybody else has a gun in their car, how long is it going to be before you think, you know, I probably ought to have a gun in my car? And if you're really stylistic about it, you're not going to want to be carrying it in and out of your car. You're going to want a gun for just that car. If you got two cars, you'll need two guns. Maybe you'll want to put one in the trunk and in the glove compartment. Maybe you'll want to duct tape one up inside the fender well just for good measure. Because you never know when you're going to have to get all sneaky to get at your gun. America, what has happened to you? And this is a disease. It'll get going in Florida. And then the National Republican and Rifle Association will want it in Alabama and Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia. And we can all be safer if we've all just got a gun in the car. Lord. It's a little embarrassing, you know what I mean? Oh, by the way, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation segment is not airing on Anderson Cooper this evening, so belay that previous TV advisory. Oh, an update, by the way. An update on the story that we talked about at some length. A month or so ago, 2 months, May 12th was when the big bust went down. An update on the Postville, Iowa kosher meat packing plant at Agriprocessors. It turns out that two supervisors there have been arrested on criminal immigration charges. The feds also have an arrest warrant out for a third man who is described by the workers as a plant manager. I'm thinking that I don't want to eat anything that came out of that place, kosher or otherwise. Not a lot of worry about me eating anything out of there, kosher or otherwise, because I'm just not eating a whole lot of anything anyway, but we know that story. Back on May 12th, the feds roared into Agriprocessors and took down a whole bunch, 389 mostly Guatemalan workers who had dummied up green cards and phony social security numbers and were working at pathetic wages in a sweatshop that was doing everything it could possibly do to keep the United Food and Commercial Workers out of the plant. Now, after the raid, the workers who were rounded up and taken to the grounds of the Iowa Cattle Congress. Some people said, Bob, that's not a cow pen or anything. It's fairgrounds. I'm sure there are no cattle displayed at the Iowa Cattle Congress grounds. And then they were given what were called expedited proceedings, expedited judicial proceedings. You know how you expedite a judicial proceeding, right? You know that? That's where you strip out all the substantive and procedural due process and equal protection of the laws and just find people guilty and deal with them. So out of all that has come an arrest warrant for a person by the name of Hossam Amara. Hossam Amara. He was a floor manager at Agriprocessors. And he was the link between the workers on the killing floors, in the abattoir, if you will, and in the meatpacking lines, and the senior management. Yeah, here's the line I was looking for. In expedited proceedings, 270 Guatemalan workers were sent to federal prison on criminal charges, most for presenting false documents when they were hired. Gotta love those expedited proceedings, don't you? Hey, you're Guatemalan. You don't have any rights under American law. You're lucky we don't shoot you. You're going to prison. So there was a Mr. Guerrero, who was a supervisor of four departments in the plant, including an abattoir, a slaughterhouse called Beef Kill. Then there was Mr. De La Rosa, who was a supervisor in Poultry Kill. Both of these people had told the immigrant workers a little bit before the raid that they needed new identity documents, so they all came along and ponied up $200 so that they could keep working. At this, it was just a labor paradise is what it was. And so they came and they ponied up their $200. Messieurs De La Rosa and Guerrero pocketed the bucks, as well as a photograph from each worker. And then the raid went down. This is just a beautiful story. It just keeps getting better. Now, the third person, Hossam Amara, he had more authority even than the line supervisors, as I said, and he has not been arrested yet. He hasn't been caught. I'm guessing he may very well be out of the country by now. Scott Frotman is a spokesman for the United Food and Commercial Workers. They tried and tried and tried to organize the plant and were constantly met at every turn by opposition and smear tactics and legal wrangling by Aaron and Shalom Rubashkin and the whole family that ran this god-awful hellhole. And Scott Frotman asked a very pertinent question. What about the allegations of worker abuse? Does anyone really believe that these low-level supervisors acted alone without the knowledge or even the direction of the Rubashkins and other senior management? You'd have to be pretty credulous to believe that now, wouldn't you? But then again, we're talking about believing. We're talking about that function of the human condition whereby one chucks out the window all rationality. Because remember when we first saw the photos coming out of Abu Ghraib? Lindy England standing there, pretending to point a gun at the naked man on the leash while a cigarette dangled off of her lip like a gun mall in some cheap 30s crime drama. And what were we told? Now, these were isolated incidents. These people never had any sort of encouragement from higher up. Nobody knew about this at the Pentagon. The generals were shocked, shocked to find this abuse was going on. Who believed it? All you had to do was turn on the radio to hear knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing, right-wing America saying, these are just some bad apples. These things happen in a war zone. They's just having fun. And then, of course, there's the $400 million man, Flush Flimball, on the air. My friends, it was really more like a fraternity prank. So, Mr. Frotman, when you ask, my friend, and I would consider you a friend, Mr. Frotman, because your issues are my issues. When you ask, what about the allegations of worker abuse, does anyone really believe that these low-level supervisors acted alone without the knowledge or even the direction of the Rubashkins and other senior management? Does anyone really believe that? Mr. Frotman, my answer to that would be, yes, of course they do. Many people believe that. Because many Americans, many working-class Americans even, have been brainwashed into believing that allowing workers to organize is somehow bad for the country. Many people believe it. Go read the comments sections from the initial reporting on this whole damn dirty raid. And read the people from right there in Postville, Iowa, who pilloried these workers. That's what they get for taking good American jobs. Well, that's the problem now, isn't it? What Aaron and Shalom Rubashkin and the Rubashkin clan were offering were not good American jobs. They were hellhole jobs. They were sweatshop jobs. They were jobs at substandard wages with substandard worker treatment, no benefits, no pension, no workers' comp, and no hope. But it's a lot easier to ask the average American, mostly white bigot, to blame the poor immigrant worker than it is to ask him to pay attention long enough to figure out for himself that this whole thing was an orchestrated con job from the top down. You cannot, look, Messieurs Guerrero and De La Rosa? You think they just came up with this thing on their own and decided to start hiring immigrant workers from Guatemala without telling management? Who told De La Rosa and Guerrero that it was going to be necessary to get new fake green cards for the workers? Hint. It's not a bottom-up sort of problem-solving process. There is hope, however. This past Thursday, down in Houston, five senior managers of a company called Action Rags USA that got raided recently made their initial court appearances. The downside to this, Action Rags USA, who were those senior managers? Why, they had names like Mubarak Kalon, Rashid Ahmed. 160 workers were rounded up there on June 25th in Houston. So one cannot help but wonder why they're still going after the little fish in Postville, Iowa at agriprocessors. Mr. Frotman, what about worker abuse? Well, Mr. Frotman, America doesn't much care about the abuse of immigrants. And historically, America never has cared much about the abuse of immigrants. Immigrants, within the grand American scheme of things, are for abusing. Whether they are the Italians whose corpses or remains or skeletal fragments remain deep in the pits of Monongah, West Virginia, where they were never recovered after the explosions of, 1907? Or whether they are Sacco and Vanzetti, executed on flimsy, at best, charges? Or whether they are 389 Guatemalan peasants at agriprocessors? Or 160 immigrant workers at Action Rags USA? Or whether they were the indentured servants, the white slaves of early colonial America? Or the African slaves? The thing that all groups have in common is they were immigrants brought here to work and die and in between time shut the hell up. Whether it's Hungarians or Serbs or Croats brought into western Pennsylvania to work the steel mills of Messrs. Mellon and Carnegie. Whether it's the Irish in New York and Boston, who scrubbed and toiled on their hands and knees, praying just to make it through another day, just to feed the children. The wheels of American industry have been oiled with the blood of immigrants. So, Mr. Frotman, what about the allegations of worker abuse? We'll listen to it here on the Horn, because we know how hard organized labor works, not just for white working America, but for African working America and Latino working America. For all of working America. We know how hard you work. And we know you work that hard because of how hard the people that you represent work. But between at least now and January 20th, Mr. Frotman, I'm afraid you're going to be hard-pressed to get the National Labor Relations Board, or the Department of Labor, or that hateful virago Elaine Chao, or her husband Mitch McConnell. I'm afraid you're going to be hard-pressed to get any of them to listen to you. If anybody hears what you said on the right, God knows you will be vilified by the right-wing echo chamber as probably some sort of communist, Bolshevik, socialist. Because that's how it works. After all, Flush Flimball recently said that he exists as a defender of corporate America. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hey, man.
Hey, boss.
I know it's late and everything. I just got done with a union meeting.
Oh, we were just talking about a union.
Well, and I've been listening to you. This was, a very good union meeting. It was my last union meeting as president. We installed a very good friend of mine who is very worthy of the whole thing. But anyway, I was listening to you a little bit there. And what we need is for working people to realize what you just were talking about and to start to stand up. You know, that is the only way we are going to change things, is for working people to stand up and demand what's right. And there's a problem with that, because a lot of them don't want to stand up. And one of the best ways you could stand up is by joining a union. And if we get a Democratic president, and sometimes I have my doubts about that, you know, they're very tricky people that we're dealing with here.
I was about to say something, but you did it better.
Okay. You know, ahead of the polls and blah, 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 and all that. You know, we were there with John Kerry. We were there with Al Gore. We, you know, and we managed to lose. The only way we can win is by the working people that you're talking about right now stand up and do the right thing. And the color of a man's skin doesn't make any difference.
Neither does his accent.
No, or where he was born, or, you
or
know,
gender.
Or, right. Whether he's white, black, pink, or whatever he is.
And that's, you know, that's the big hurdle, isn't it, Wayne? Is getting over, getting across to people that we're not talking about ethnicities, and we're not talking about gender, and we're not talking about language. We're talking about workers. There
that's
are workers.
Exactly what we're talking about.
All there are in this country are people who work and people who don't.
That's exactly right. And if you wait for a check every Thursday or Friday, you're a worker. So, you know, we got to stand up. If we get a Democratic president and gain majorities in the Senate and the House, we can pass the Employees Free Choice Act. If we do that and we rewrite these NLRB rules and put people in there that actually believe in working people and are willing to fight for working people, then a lot of the problems that we have will somehow seem to solve themselves.
And yeah, things like the healthcare crisis.
Yes, I have healthcare. All my members have healthcare, and you know who pays for that healthcare? Our employer. And for a working person, that is not too much to ask. For someone that's willing to go to work every day, 5 days a week, and put in their 40 hours, or do overtime if their employer requests, for that person to ask to have a living wage, health insurance for them and their family, and a retirement where they can retire with dignity, is not too much for a working person to ask.
It's damned little if you ask me when you get right down to it.
That's exactly right.
It's a de minimis standard.
Most working people don't want that much. They want what I just described. I remember the first ticket I ever did, and a television person came up to me and asked me, "What do you want? What do you guys want?" And I said, the first thing you have to understand is that no one standing on that line over there wants to fly to Paris for lunch. That ain't us. You know.
Yeah.
It's not too much to ask.
No, it isn't by any stretch of the imagination. You know, and you mentioned getting past ethnicity and gender and all that stuff. It's worth reminding people that American unions are trying to do that. United Food and Commercial Workers aren't out there asking, whether or not you've got good WASPish credentials, and your own union actively reaches out to people with Spanish language outreach via radio, via the magazine, everything.
Exactly. Our quarterly Carpenter's magazine is printed half in Spanish. You know, working people are working people. It doesn't matter what your color of your skin or your nationality or We're all workers. That's all we are. And, you know, there's a great sense of pride in that.
Yeah, there is. Because the fact of the matter is, Wayne, if you lick that problem, you've got the rest of the problems on the run because you're standing together at that point.
Well, what if, you know, like in some European countries, what if 80% of the people in this country were in a union? More than likely, 80% of them people would have health insurance, they would have a retirement, and they would have a living wage. That would seem to solve a lot of problems to me.
I can't think of many that it wouldn't.
Exactly.
I mean, we wouldn't need things like stimulus checks because the economy would stay stimulated have enough money to fool around and enjoy themselves with. You know, whether it's a new TV or, you know, you wouldn't sweat bullets if the refrigerator kicked off or you needed a new washing machine. Because you're making a decent wage and you can go buy one.
Think about that stimulus package. What, $300, $600 for couples or something? I guess if you had a couple of kids, you could get 12.
Yeah.
Even if you got $1,200, this winter, that would probably buy, fuel oil. I think the last I paid was $4.25, so it'll probably be $5 or $6 by the time November rolls around. But, you know, how far will that go?
Yeah, it'd be, $5, a 100 gallons would be $500.
Right. 100 gallons, if it was $5 an hour.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
A gallon.
Yeah, 100 gallons, $500. If you're heating with fuel oil, that's not a lot of heat. Or that's not heat for long time.
No, it isn't. So if you spent all your money and got, you know, so you bought yourself a month or two where you and your family doesn't freeze. Wow, what a wonderful stimulus that is.
Yeah, hey, not freezing.
Yeah,
that really is the key to that. Really
we
is the key
go to Europe, but we won't freeze.
Oh God, thanks, Wayne.
I know it's getting late.
Well, congratulations on a term well served there at the local.
Hey, it was an honor. It was definitely an honor. So. I'll talk to you later, pal.
All right. Take care.
All right, brother.
Bye now. That's Wayne. And if you had a half an idea, and you probably do, of the amount of time that he poured into being the president of that local, you would stand in just awe. So I guess that's the program for tonight. Yeah, we got about 6 minutes before the hour. And yeah, that's the program for tonight. We've been all over the place. Iraq, Afghanistan, back here to home, guns, the environment. Where else are you going to get this? I would suggest you'll be hard pressed to find this on terrestrial radio. God knows you won't get it on right-wing radio. We're mighty proud of what we do here at the Horn. Mighty proud indeed. And mighty proud of the people that we stand for and stand with. And proud to have your support. Proud to know that you find this to be valuable enough to keep going. If you've never contributed to keeping the Horn on the air, there's a PayPal button right on the website, headonradionetwork.com. If you prefer to send it by mail, it's Head On, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia, 25938. Thanks to the new contributors. Thanks to the contributors who have been with us for a year now. It's a year you've kept us going. And that says a bucketful. Thank you. Thank you indeed. Thank you to the highly frustrated Peter Godbold, our IT consultant down in Florida. Hopefully he'll be back and rocking by tomorrow evening. Lord knows if yelling at an ISP could make something make miracles happen, Peter will be a miracle worker. Thanks to John Fox, our chief engineer and webmaster in Sydney, Australia. Thanks to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Ben's the one who makes the streams do what streams do, and the archives and the podcast, the live stream, that all happens through Ben at WhiteRoseSociety.org. He's raising funds, too, and he needs your help. A special thanks, and I was so glad to see so many of you this past weekend, and the ones I didn't see, we missed. You know who you are. Thanks to our friends at Coal River Mountain Watch, who partially sponsor everything that happens on the Horn. I've said before, and I will say again and again and again, that they are the hardest working, bravest people I know. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.